Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you know why you do what you do? In order to act rationally and appropriately, we are all inclined to trust our senses to assess the state of the world around us. But that may be a mistake, because it turns out human brains play a lot of tricks on their owners, in part to keep us happy, hopeful, and connected to other people. Journalist David McCraney writes about such psychological fallacies in his popular blog, You Are Not So Smart. His new book is called You Are Now Less Dumb: How to Conquer Mob Mentality, How to Buy Happiness, and All the Other Ways to Outsmart Yourself. David, welcome back to Think.
Wow, thank you so much for having me back.
Your point here is, of course, that we're not so dumb, not so bad, but we would all do well to question what we think we know about ourselves and the world.
Yeah, you know, I'm most fascinated with the overconfidence and sort of the, when I write about biases and fallacies and all the other stuff, the part that always makes me smile and gets me going and wants me to encourages me to write more about this stuff is sort of the narrative that we write around our own behaviors and the curiously overconfident way we approach ourselves, and we're blind to our faults, even though a lot of this stuff is now quantified and is out there, and it's starting to enter in the public consciousness and become part of the new common sense. But we're still strangely unaware of how unaware we are. And I like to say that we're sort of the unreliable narrator in the story of our own lives, and that's the part that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, you say self-delusion is as much part of the human condition as having fingers and toes.
Right. You know, it's... We have learned over the last few, 100 years, we've learned that, if you eat too much of one thing, you don't exercise, or, if you strain your eyes, we've learned that there are all sorts of things that come along with having a human body, and owning a human body means that you get all the benefits and all the flaws all in one package, and we sort of have neglected to... we're familiar with being forgetful and all sorts of other little things like that, but there's a whole bestiary, this whole catalog of really fascinating, interesting, and entertaining ways that we're deeply flawed mentally, just by having a normal human brain.
So how does this thing called narrative bias affect the way we absorb information from the world around us and then force us to immediately start looking for causes and effects where they may not exist?
Well, I think that... there's a branch of psychology that's just emerging right now that called narrative psychology, that it speculates that human beings are more interested in seeking meaning and inventing narratives than we are in seeking happiness and achieving goals, and that narrative sort of is the underlying lattice by which we weave our understanding or conception of ourself, and it's something that we appreciate both coming and going. So we're more likely to understand and remember, and we're more likely to engage with information that's presented to us in a narrative fashion. And that's not because we just love a good story. It's because that's how we actually make sense of reality, both as it's occurring and most especially in memory. We tend to see things. Everyone is their own protagonist, and we tend to break things up into story arcs, and they have a beginning and a middle and end, and everything is just nicely cinched up in a narrative package when we look back on our lives. And since that's just the way the mind works, it seems that's true from the latest research, that we're more likely to enjoy and engage with information that's presented to us in that way, and that's also why we create artistically. We create so many things in narrative form, and we have that sort of intuition when something is not... it's not being done properly, or it's being done in a way that's too experimental or doesn't follow it in the natural way that we understand ourselves. So when I write about narrative bias in the book, I go into that in detail and explain the story of people who are deeply delusional, who have delusions that are very obvious. You know, they believe that they're Jesus or something like that. And despite having those incredibly fanciful delusions, that they're very useful for those people to keep themselves from completely de-resing into just a series of inputs and outputs. You need that narrative to keep everything cohesion.
Well, another thing that's true about us is that when we are confronted with information that conflicts with the things that we believe pretty strongly, the more evidence there is, the more we assume that it must be wrong.
That's, in my first book, I talked a lot about confirmation bias, and I think that it's been great to see over the last few years that confirmation bias has really become part of a national and worldwide dialogue. It's one of those things that we're all starting to see about ourselves. And if you've never been presented with it, I'm sure you have, but your audience has. The confirmation bias is our tendency to pay more attention to things that confirm our preconceived notions about the world and pay less attention to things that don't. And it's not an active process. It's just part of being a person. And you will you'll be more likely to remember things that confirm your beliefs. You'll be more skeptical of things that disconfirm them, and so on. And that sort of builds up your library of information and your literal library in your home or the websites you visit. We tend to really seek confirmation, and science is the sort of the method by which we seek disconfirmation, and that's why it's so valuable, such a good tool. But what I talk about in the new book is something called the backfire effect, and this is a very recent discovery in psychology that's just now being unraveled. And it's really bizarre. It's best to describe it by actually telling you how the study that discovered it worked out. They show people a news story that matches that person's preconceived notions, and this, all the stories are fake in this, even though they're based off of real information. And then they ask the person to rate how much faith they have in that story's accuracy. So in one particular run of this, they said there were they gave people a story that said there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and so people who were very pro-war or very conservative, whatever reasons that they believed that was a true statement, they would report that was a well-written story. Mm-hmm. And then they would show people a fake correction that was in this story. In this particular instance, it was saying, oh, guess what, there actually weren't weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I'm sorry, it was incorrect. Here's the correction. And then they asked people to rate the story now that they know that it was incorrect. And people tended to rate it as being even more factual, even they had more faith in the story after they saw a correction. Hmm. And you can see this even in stories that are corrected in line, where a person can see the corrections as they read. And they label it the backfire effect. And it's this is something you should know about whenever you go enter into one of those arguments we tend to get on social media. If you're arguing with your uncle or something about politics or religion or anything on the internet, you're never going to win that argument, because as both parties dig deeper into the internet and Google things to back up themselves and bring up all these facts, you're just watching two people get deeper and deeper into their preconceived notions, and nothing is being solved.
So how is it that we can get compliments on something all day, whether it's an achievement we've done or what we're wearing or whatever, and we don't necessarily, those don't necessarily stick with us for a long time, but if one person says something that seems a little mean or really sort of cuts us down, that's the thing we recall.
When your beliefs are challenged, or when your ideals of your conception of yourself is challenged, it's something that immediately brings up cognitive dissonance, and it has to be addressed.
Hmm.
If compliments kind of just glide over us, they kind of keep us our head above water when it comes to feeling efficacy and everything. But if you start to be pushed down into the water and you're having to struggle with something that doesn't match up your preconceived notions, well, it has to be addressed. Now, there's a zillion different ways this is explored in psychology, and I specifically write about how I tend to think that, or I lend credit toward pouring over that data tends to strengthen the actual physical connections and build memories around the effort you've put out. And that's why, and this is true for anybody who puts out anything creative, that if you you can receive 1,000 compliments about something, but just one tiny two-sentence, negative response or review or whatever, that's what you will think about in the shower for 2 weeks.
Hmm. Because the compliments were like, well, of course, you're correct. I'm the cupcakes I baked are delicious. But the one person who said those are terrible, that just seems shocking to us.
Yeah, and you're placed at a crossroads where you have to say, okay, is this person correct? If they're correct, and then there's a whole line of dialogue you're having with yourself. Or you have this other cognition, you're like, okay, this person's not correct. And here's this whole line of dialogue that you have with yourself. And you may end up, a lot of times when we argue with people online, it's not really about trying to prove the facts of the case are true is trying to prove that you aren't silly and ridiculous for having believed in the way you did going into the argument. So, and, you know, that's something that we will defend to our dying day if we have to.
I love reading about what's called the Benjamin Franklin effect, which is we think we do nice things for people because we like them, when in fact we come to like the people we do nice things for, and we come to particularly dislike the people we have harmed.
This is true. This is a long-running exploration in psychology, and it's one of the sort of the through lines. It's one of the major themes of the new book, and I'm really fascinated by the idea that there's this chicken and egg argument that is made in modern psychology, and that is, do our attitudes follow behavior, or do our behaviors follow our attitudes? You can think of it as, if I want to conduct myself in a business-like manner, do I go to my closet and pick out a suit and put that on and then go to the interview? Or when I pick out that suit and put it on and go to the interview, do I then conduct myself in a business-like manner? It's a question that seems to be, or the credit seems to be going in the direction of you observe your own behaviors, and then your attitude follows the narrative that you create to explain yourself to yourself. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's got so much credit in psychology right now is because when you put people in the lab and you give them the opportunity to explain their behaviors, they're very inaccurate. People tend to come up with just self-serving explanations that don't really match the reality of the situation. And I love the story of the Benjamin Franklin effect because it shows how this was done actually in a wonderful historical example. Benjamin Franklin had, as he was running for state assembly in Philadelphia, he had this very vocal hater. He never really names him in his autobiography, but someone who was a real pain to him, and he knew that in the future he'd have to deal with him as a political rival, and so he felt like he had to snuff this guy out in some way. And so he pulled this trick that's now called the Benjamin Franklin effect, where Benjamin Franklin was well known as a collector of rare books, and he learned that this man had a particular book that Franklin would like to read, and so he sent him a letter that said, I would be forever in your debt if you would allow me to read this fine book that I hear that you have. And the guy was flattered, and he sent the book over, and then Franklin returned it a week later and with a thank you note and said, you know, if you ever need anything from me, just let me know. And from that point forward, the man who had spent so much time as a detractor of Franklin flipped completely around and became a fan of Franklin, started doing speeches for him, and he was willing to help Franklin whenever he needed. And so I talk about that in the book, and I go into all the different explanations from modern psychology as to why would that have happened. And most of them boil down to when he was trying to explain his own behavior to himself, he thought, I would never be so inconsistent as to have done something nice for someone that I hate. And so he rewrote his own reality to be that he didn't do something for someone that he hated. He actually does like Franklin, and he proceeded forward from that day as if he did. And the same thing can be negative, though. There's several theories, insufficient justification theory, cognitive dissonance theory, all these things boil into it. But we do know from situations like Abu Ghraib and other situations like that, and military combat scenarios and stuff, when you are doing harm to other individuals and you're faced with having to explain your behavior, we tend to vilify those that we harm. So it can work in either direction. We tend to do nice things and spread kindness and become kind toward those that we spread kindness toward, but we also tend to vilify and hate those that we're forced to do bad things for as well.
My guest is journalist David McRaney. He writes the blog You Are Not So Smart, and he's got a new book out called You Are Now Less Dumb, How to Conquer Mob Mentality, How to Buy Happiness, and all the other ways to outsmart yourself. You're welcome to join us now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist and blogger David McRaney. His blog is called You Are Not So Smart. He has a new book out as well called You Are Now Less Dumb, How to Conquer Mob Mentality, How to Buy Happiness, and all the other ways to outsmart yourself. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So we all like to be part of something bigger than ourselves, right? And we assume that the more people who agree with us, David, the more correct our beliefs must be. But it turns out there may not be so much wisdom in crowds as we would like to think.
Yeah, you have to be careful. Not all, not every consensus is made, equal to this. It's, I think that, it's very natural for whenever we are plops down into a new scenario, we tend to, look for what are people doing around us, what are the common beliefs, and I think we assume that we have a lot of skepticism toward that sort of thing, but we rarely notice whenever we're being unfairly unskeptical. And I like to write about the common belief fallacy in the book, and what I focus on both in that and in the post hoc fallacy is sort of this strange belief that lasts beyond the easy debunking of those beliefs through, like, Google or through just through scientific education. I know that I write about fan death. It's a very common belief in South Korea that if you're stuck in a room, if you stay in a room with the doors closed and you have an oscillating fan going, you will die. And that it sucks all the oxygen out of the room and it will kill you. And it's a pretty pervasive belief. I have a friend who is staying there and teaching English, and she said that most of the fans have a safety mechanism to turn them off, and not really for safety, but for peace of mind, because it's something that people still believe despite being obviously debunked. But in the United States, there are similar things. There's I write about the power balance bracelet. this is something that Bill Clinton wore, Bill Clinton's a smart guy. He's he was leader of the free world for a while there, but this power balance bracelet is just a piece of rubber with a hologram on it that supposedly has magic in it. So it's like you're basically wearing an amulet in 2013, and we have to assume that if it's a real magical amulet at the factory that they make these things, when it gets right before it goes in the box, they must have like a team of wizards that are putting a magic wand over the box and before they send them out. And rightly so, they were eventually sued, massively sued, and they lost whenever they were, scientists actually said, okay, I guess we have to do this. Let's put this in a lab and see if it improves performance. And, what they discovered in the lab when it came to these power balance bracelets is that, as long as you believe in it, you can wear a bit of string around your wrist, it would still work. Even in studies where they tell people they have a lucky golf ball, and it's completely randomized where the scientist doesn't know, and neither does the person, which one some people randomly get a regular golf ball. They all get the same golf ball, but some people are randomly told that it's magic. The people who believe that it's a lucky golf ball, they will sink more putts. So there is magic in those power balance amulets, but the magic is in your belief in the object.
And I guess depending on what it is, it doesn't really, it may be harmless or it may be something we need to sort of be aware of. I mean, my daughter for a while thought if she ate cold pizza before a soccer game, she would score a goal.
Right.
It doesn't hurt to let her have some pizza. But, if it's something really, if it's affecting behavior in ways that could really be serious, then you ought to think twice.
Yeah, when something like that replaces actual medicine, that's when we have a problem. If somebody is treating their cancer with some sort of, nostrum or sundry that's totally ineffectual and has no medical value whatsoever, that's when we have to be careful. There's a great website, I think it's called What's the Harm, that actually lists things like that have caused harm. In everything that I write about in both books, these strange things that our brains do that lead us astray, they are adaptive, in the sense that they, over the long course of our evolutionary history, these things have done more good things for us than bad. But we find ourselves in modern life in situations that are not the same as they're not the same pressures that changed our brains over our long evolutionary history, or we just may find ourselves in situations that aren't the best scenarios for those biases to express themselves. And that's when you need to understand how your mind works so that what's usually benign You need to know when the instances when it may cause harm.
And one thing there is the sort of bias that we have in favor of people who are physically attractive and against people who are physically unattractive, which may have an evolutionary basis or a cultural basis, but it can really do some harm.
Yeah, this is a great example of what I was talking about when it comes to our overconfidence and our skepticism and our perception. I think we all know that beautiful people have a leg up. We all know that that people who are physically intimidating are going to have a leg up when it comes to scenarios and when leadership scenarios and stuff like that. We all have an intuition about that, but what we think is that we know when we're being affected by it, and we know when we're guarding ourselves against it. But when you put people in the lab, you can see that that's just not necessarily true. Just broadly speaking, every inch of height above average height, above 6 feet, if that's the average height in where you live, earns a person around $800 more a year for every inch. And when you put one of my favorite studies in the whole book is that they had people, and these are scientists that did this. I'm not calling these people beautiful and plain. Scientists made this determination, but they gave people an essay, and the essay was written by the scientists. And one group gets an essay with a photograph attached to it of a beautiful woman, and the scientists say, this is the author of your essay. And another group gets the exact same essay in every way, but they get a different picture of a woman who is plain. Again, scientists said this. Mm-hmm. And they are then asked to grade that essay on how well it's written, the depth, the understanding of the subject matter. And people graded the essays with the more beautiful picture attached as being better essays, as being better written essays. And when they made those essays purposely poorly written in another run of this experiment, the gulf between the two ratings actually expanded. So people were not only did they rate people more highly if they were attractive, but they gave them, they forgave them more readily. But what's most fascinating about that study is that when you poll people afterward and ask them if the photograph had any bearing in your decision, the people say no. They don't realize that the effect is there. They don't realize that it's changing their actual perception on the matter. And since most of our life we don't actually get the chance to run things twice or see if what it was like when another group did something with a slightly different variable, we proceed as if we're being aware, if we were vigilant against these things.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Susan in Garland. Hello, Susan.
Hi. This is just fascinating, and I'm calling to comment on the discussion about how one negative thing can override all the compliments that you might receive.
Right.
I recently had a job interview, and out of, 15, let's say there was 15 categories, and exceeded all of them except one, and it bothered me so much. Is this why?
You're asking if that's why that probably happened, that it bothered you so much. What do you think, David?
I mean, my speculation is that it seems to me that we would rather have that happen in our minds than not. I mean, because things that are dangerous or things that are need to be addressed in our environment, you will pay attention to those things, and things that are running smoothly, they just get to be put off to the side. So it's crippling, and it can cause lots of anxiety. And of course, there are situations where it's maladaptive, but in the long run, it's probably better for us than not. But I would assume that, yeah, I mean, that's something that, like, you don't want that to happen again in another job interview, and you don't want those things that were said about you to be true. So you're faced with that, you're at that crossroads where I either have to accept this or have to deny it. And either way, I'm going to have to put a lot of thought into how I'm going to go about doing that. Whereas all the other things, they don't need any second thought at all. You can just go about and brush your teeth and never think about them again.
Some of this may come back to, and not in Susan's case, because I don't know Susan, and I'm going to assume that she's fantastic. But this thing called the self-enhancement bias. Tell us about that.
Well, self-enhancement bias is this sort of giant umbrella term that incorporates many other smaller subsidiary biases, and in general, what it's just very simply, it's difficult to be a person. It's hard to get out of bed in the morning and put your feet on the floor and go do things.
Right.
And it's difficult because you have such a complicated mind. Most of our animal friends, they don't have to worry about things. They don't think about regret or they don't worry about loss or meaning or those sort of things. And we are sort of burdened by that stuff. And so we have this collection of mental agencies that keep us overconfident, and they keep us we are overly positive in our assessments of our own selves. It's the sort of thing where, you know, if people believe, if you look at statistics that say that you are, you know, if you're a smoker and you look at statistics that say you have a very high chance of getting cancer, then you're going to be like, well, I'm not one of the people who's going to get that. And if you ask people to rate themselves, if you ask college professors especially to rate themselves, how good of a teacher are you? You'll get like a 98% of people will say they're above average. The same thing if you ask people about how good of a driver are you, or how good a listener are you. Anything you can rate someone on, people will always respond back saying, I'm a little bit better than average. And, of course, that's impossible. Not everyone can be average. Not everyone can be above average, or there wouldn't be an average. But that's the weirdest thing about it is that when this is malfunctioning, when a person doesn't do this, when you're actually starkly realistic about yourself, it's called depressive realism. And around 20% of people are like this. They actually see themselves for what they are, and they accurately describe their own selves and their place in the world. And it's maladaptive. It makes it difficult to proceed. So obviously having this ability, that there are several things in it. Illusory superiority bias, that's when you see yourself as slightly above average in all categories. And then there's the illusion of control. That's when you tend to mistake your personal luck for being skill. And there's also optimism bias, which is the belief that, you know, things are always getting better. And those combined together, we want to have those things in our lives. But with the advent of certain technological advances, like I write about in the book, just having Facebook in front of you where you can constantly curate a highlight reel of your life, it can encourage people to start to bleed over into the narcissism spectrum and actually go toward full-blown narcissism. And other weird things can be teased out of it because of this natural tendency to want to see ourselves slightly above average.
Is it also universal for humans to think of themselves as good people at heart, regardless of the things they've done that would seem to prove otherwise?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that you see that in a lot of different studies. And we tend to believe that whatever groups we belong to are the good groups, and the mm-hmm. other groups that oppose them are the bad ones. And we tend to believe that whatever personality traits that we see as that we can identify in ourselves, we also believe that those personality traits are the kind that people ought to have. And you're really sort of always painting this this beautiful portrait of who we are, and unconsciously and passively, but when pressed, also actively. And it's good. It's adaptive. Without it, it would be very tough to get out of bed in the morning, and I would rather have these things than not. But it's important to know whenever they're getting in the way of something you might want out of life.
Another thing that seems to be adaptive is the fact that ultimately we tend to decide that whatever is available to us based on our actions or our choices is better than whatever we have made unavailable to us. In other words, if we, you know, decided not to take chemistry in college and so we can't become a neurosurgeon, we'll decide eventually that we were much better off in PR or whatever.
Right. It's very similar to what we were just talking about. That's called subjective optimization. I love those psychological terms.
Yeah.
So nice. And it's just basically seeing the life you have as the best life that you could have ever had. And it's in the more unchangeable your situation, the more that tendency is inflamed. And you will especially see it in people who are in very bad situations. Mm. And they will say, you know, if somebody gets in some sort of political scandal and their career is destroyed, you come back to them a couple years later and they'll say, you know what they're going to say. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. And you're going to hear that a lot with people who are forced down a path they weren't expecting to take. And it has all these other side effects that are really strange and unusual that I write about in the book, and I talk about something called the illusion of external agency. And when you feel that your life is better than you have any right to have, which you usually do when you're in an unchangeable bad situation and you repaint it to be something that was actually positive, if you can't determine a source of your good fortune, people tend to look for an outside agent. And the more random and nebulous that agent is made in a lab, the more people tend to believe in it, whether it's a computer or whether it's they tell people that they've been affected by subliminal messages or whatever, even when those things are completely not true, people tend to put a lot of credit into them when they're looking for a source of their good fortune that they've created themselves.
So what does all this suggest, David, about these big decisions that we tend to agonize over, whether to, you know, move for a job or what to study or whether to have a family and when? Can we just relax and figure we will be about as happy no matter what we choose?
Well, we can try to relax.
Easier said than done, right?
It's that's one of the odd things about all this stuff is that, you know, 100%, you can never have 100% self-knowledge, but even as you approach it through all these means, it doesn't stop your instinctive responses. It doesn't get rid of them. I write about in the book a really strange thing when it comes to just happiness in general. You know, I think that when you ask people if they would rather have less sleep, like I'm going to take away a whole day's worth of sleep from you in the week, but you're going to add another $100,000 to your income. You know, most people in America and in the modern United States will take that offer. They'll say, yeah, I'd rather have, I will take one day less sleep for more money. But the research shows that it's just not true that more money makes you happier. Actually, in the modern United States, happiness plateaus around $75,000 a year income. And anything above that does not add to your day-to-day happiness. And it's very counterintuitive, and people really don't want to believe that that's true. And the odd thing about that means that a person who makes $1 million a year versus a person who makes $75,000 a year, their day-to-day happiness really isn't any different. If you were pursuing happiness itself, just raw happiness as a goal, you're better off seeking better off using your money on experiences, because experiences last for a very long time, and material objects fade and their luster very quickly, within 3 months of most things. And so most psychologists would recommend to you that you need to build incredible memories and not look for material gains.
David McRaney is with us. He's a journalist who blogs at You Are Not So Smart. His new book is called You Are Now Less Dumb: How to Conquer Mob Mentality, How to Buy Happiness, and All the Other Ways to Outsmart Yourself. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes and take more of your calls and emails. The phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author David McRaney about his new book, You Are Now Less Dumb: How to Conquer Mob Mentality, How to Buy Happiness, and All the Other Ways to Outsmart Yourself. You can also find David's blog online. It's called You Are Not So Smart. If you want to be part of the conversation, send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Scott in Dallas, who writes, these ideas could possibly explain why in the U.S. the majority, white people, do not perceive there is prejudice, but minorities do. Can you comment on this?
Actually, I write about a really bizarre thing in the book called pluralistic ignorance, and that is it's tangentially related to that. Let me address this question directly, though. Yeah, I think that he specifically is talking about how powerful confirmation bias can be, and then there's all the subsidiary, associated biases that sort of help confirmation bias live and breathe and be one of the most powerful agents in our mind. Not only do we find it, you know, repulsive to believe that maybe we're in some sort of privileged position, and all we look back on all the things that may have happened in our lives that make us feel icky, and we want to change things to make ourselves better and make our place in the world better, and that weird feeling that you have is going to be somewhat subdued by these positive illusions. And also, as you try to look out into the world and disprove that fact to yourself, you're going to only look for confirmation. You're only going to look for information that tends to paint you in a positive light, and you're going to tend to avoid things that paint you in a negative light. And strangely enough, you know, people get mad at very right-leaning or very left-leaning news agencies, and they think that they're brainwashing people. But it's that's totally not the case. It's more likely that people are just trying to find some place that plays nice with their belief system, and they're not really looking for information, they're looking for confirmation. And when you find a place like that, you'll stick with it, because all day long you can sit there and feel like, okay, my opinion is accurate, it's better. And the strange case of pluralistic ignorance is that thing where if you're in a classroom, say, and the teacher says, how many people here don't understand what I'm saying? Let's say you're in a very difficult trigonometry class or something. The majority of the class can actually be in a state of mind where they do wish that the teacher would explain things better, but no one raises their hand, because when you look around, no one else is raising their hand. You think that maybe you're the only person that feels the way that you feel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very strange situation where you are in the majority, but you feel like you're in the minority because people act differently on the inside than they portray on the outside.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go out to McKinney now and speak with Deborah. Hey, Deborah.
Hi there.
Hey.
Yeah, my question, it's actually a comment and a question. So it's kind of a two-part thing. But I was fascinated with your study about less attractive people, that part of the conversation where you put people in the lab and you said that they didn't know when they were looking at the attractive woman that they were being prejudiced on mm-hmm. behalf of the attractiveness. And I'm just, my first thought was like, really? And then I thought, well, what if you actually took people out of the lab? Has that ever been done where, you know, they're obviously letting some gorgeous thing in front of them in line or, you know, whatever they do, because it's all kinds of things that they do. I'm one of the not attractive ones. That's how I know, because I've had it happen, you know, to me where I'm, you know, or they're just looking right at me and they're making it very clear that, you know, I'm not for you, you know, because you're one of them. So, but, oh, look here. Well, we'll give her or him the goodies, so to speak. And if you actually followed them as subjects and then asked them, why did you do that, what do you think they would say?
Interesting question. Thanks for your call, Deborah.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Deborah. And, you know, don't let anybody, you know, define your own sense of worth or beauty, okay? Because beauty is something that is so ephemeral and transient. I mean, the standards of beauty change from era to era, culture to culture. So yeah, don't let anybody get you down in that way. It's such a it's so culturally driven. It's not just purely evolutionary.
That's beautifully stated, by the way. Thank you for that.
Sure. The and it's true. That's the best part of it. I have science to back it. But when it comes to a lot of these studies have been done both inside and outside the lab. You know, a lot of things usually actually start outside the lab and they move into the lab for more control. But when it comes to explaining your own behavior to yourself, I mean, there's so many studies in which people have a very hard time of explaining why they did what they did. Right around the book, the Capilano Canyon study is one of these famous examples where they had a woman standing in the middle of a suspension bridge, a very scary suspension bridge, like something out of Indiana Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And they had men walked by, she would pick one of them out of the group and say, hey, could you help me do this study? And they would fill out a questionnaire, and then at the end of it, she would write her name on the back of a piece of paper and hand it to them and say, if you have any questions about the study, call me. And then they repeated that study on a bridge that was very, very safe and easy to navigate. It wasn't even necessary. And they found that a much larger percentage of men would call the woman back on the bridge that was very scary, and they also, a much higher percentage of men in that same scenario, believed that she had some sort of romantic intentions. And what they were saying, what they speculated in the study, was that they were misattributing their arousal, and arousal in the sense of they had an elevated anxiety and emotional height from just being scared to death on that bridge. They mistaken the source of that arousal to the person they were talking to on that bridge, and they didn't do it on the safe bridge. And when that study was taken out of that environment with lots of uncontrollable variables and moved into the lab, we see that it is true, yes. It's definitely something that people do. And I'm not aware of any particular studies about what she was referring to, but I do know that outside and inside the lab, real life and in controlled environments, that you do see this tendency to explain ourselves to ourselves and be very, very wrong about what we're saying.
This misattribution of arousal is really interesting because it can also be applied, as it turns out, to existing relationships. And it turns out couples are better off, like, going out and skydiving together or doing something brand new than they are sort of curling up with a bottle of wine and watching a romantic comedy.
Yeah, the real killer of relationships, and I just recently was able to, after finishing the book, I was able to interview a psychologist about this one topic, and she was telling me that she has a great book called Smart Money, and she was talking about how, you know, the real relationship killer is boredom more than anything else, and that you can hijack, you know, the popular term these days is life hack or mind hack, but, you know, you can hijack these tendencies for good. You're much more likely to stay, to strengthen and stay in true to a relationship with another person if you were constantly having new experiences together, learning new things together. And definitely if you're misattributing your arousal, it's not a bad thing to take a date on a roller coaster or get coffee or anything that that injects novelty into the relationship is going to strengthen your bond with another person for a variety of different reasons.
If willpower is a finite resource, what uses it up every day?
Well, there are several explanations of this, and it hasn't been settled. But this is one of those things where it's called ego depletion, and we know that it's a real, true effect that does happen, but why it happens, we're not quite sure about. And when I say we, I'm talking about the scientists that I write about, not necessarily myself. But according to the scientists who work on this, we know that whenever you engage in a behavior that requires self-control, willpower, that it will make it difficult to engage in another behavior unrelated to that behavior subsequently. So, and then so on and so on and so on until you're completely depleted of all your willpower. And it makes willpower seem like some sort of finite resource. In the lab, they have people, they're told, they have people sit in front of cookies and radishes, and they're told that they're doing some sort of study into food science or whatever. There's a fake story to cover up what they're actually doing. And one group is told that they can have as many cookies as they want, and the other group is told that they can't have any of the cookies. And then after that, they move them on to a second round of study where they have them perform, they work on puzzles that can't be solved. But the people don't know that they're unsolvable, and they just simply measure how long will a person work on this puzzle until they give up. And they see that people who had to stay their hands and not eat the cookies will give up much sooner than people who were allowed to eat the cookies as much as they wanted to. And we see this effect in both directions. It can happen when people are, you can do the puzzle first and do the cookies and radishes second. Either way you go, every subsequent event, whether you're told to not laugh at a joke or not cry at a rousing, at a sad movie, you can completely deplete your ability to engage in self-control by engaging in self-control alone. And there are two possible explanations for it. Some people believe, some scientists believe that it's just glucose, that as your brain starts to have less and less fuel to operate, that it will become less and less able to engage in willpower. But that's losing some credit now because some people, scientists are saying actually what's happening is you have some sort of governor in the mind. It's not really understood how that would work, but it's telling you that you've engaged in so much self-control that it's now time for you to go into downtime, and there are some like evolutionary explanations for it. So why we do it, not exactly understood, but it's definitely something you need to watch out for, and it's a good explanation for why after a long day at work where you're dealing with all sorts of problems, you'll come home and you'll just sit there and mindlessly go through television, and if you're like me, sometimes you'll watch movies that have commercials in them, even though you own the movie right over there in the bookshelf. You just plop it in and watch it from beginning to end, but you just don't want to do it. You just want to engage in something very passive.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone to Mike in Dallas. Hey, Mike.
Hi. I just wanted to follow up on the discussion regarding the experiment showing grading bias on essays based on beauty. And my question is, what do the evaluators think the adaptive benefit is? Because it would seem that it would generally lead you in the wrong direction.
That's an interesting question.
It's a great question. It's a good example of, like, you know, we don't necessarily, and this is all, of course, anything, once we get into what is the adaptive advantage, this is going to be total speculation, whether it's from me or from a person who is an expert in the topic, a scientific expert in the topic, because any evolutionary explanation is going to be highly speculative. But you can reason out that how good a person is at performing on an essay is not something that's been happening long enough in our species for there to have been adaptive pressure against it. And so our judgment of that particular trait is not something that we have a go-to instinctual response for, but our judgment of how symmetrical a person is or how healthy they are or how good of a mate they might be for us, that's something that has been selected against for a very long time. And if we know anything is true, and this is something that Daniel Kahneman is very famous for, and he has a great book about it called Thinking Fast and Slow, is that when we're faced with a difficult problem, we oftentimes will try to look for a simpler problem that's related to it and solve that problem and assume that we solved the difficult problem. And in this case, something is called the affect heuristic, which is sort of your the way something makes you feel emotionally becomes the answer for what the way something makes you for the something that requires a lot more nuance to understand. And so if I like the way that person looks, I will also like the way that person writes, and even though the two are unrelated.
And setting aside physical beauty, even something like whether or not an individual is wearing a lab coat can affect how smart we think they are.
Oh, wow. This is so great. This is a new, very, very new research that's just being unraveled called enclothed cognition. And it comes out of a previous research into something called embodied cognition, and that came out of something called priming. We know that a person who's placed in an environment that if they're placed in a room that has a briefcase, they'll be more aggressive in communicating with other people and negotiating things than they will if you have a neutral object like a backpack. So we already know that objects are infused with meaning and that symbolic meaning can influence our behavior. But in this study, they wanted to see what happens when you actually wear that object. And they divided people into three groups. One group looked at a white coat, and they were told the white coat was a doctor's coat, and they were asked to write an essay about doctors. Another group was handed a white coat, and they were told it was a painter's smock. And another group was handed a white coat, and they were told it was a doctor's coat. And those two groups actually put on this coat. And then all three groups proceeded forward, and they did tests of mental agility, puzzles and matching and all sorts of word problems. And so they found that later the people who were wearing the doctor's coat, even though it's just a neutral coat and some people are told it's a doctor's coat and some people are told that it's a painter's smock, people who thought it was a doctor's coat, they performed the best on those tasks.
They're not doctors.
They're not doctors. And then the second group that performed second best were people who just looked at a coat that they thought was a doctor's coat. And the people who performed the poorest performers were people who thought they were wearing a painter's smock. And so whatever happens when it comes to embodied cognition and priming, those strange effects, they are greatly enhanced whenever you actually put the object on. It's almost as if it is actually enchanted. But it's because, you know, you have this deep associative architecture between doctors and performing and having more, paying more attention to things and feeling more doctor-like. And it would seem that objects that are infused with meaning, their meaning has more effect on our behavior when we actually feel them against our skin, when we don them. We fulfill the role that we believe that those things are associated with.
The new book by David McCraney is called You Are Now Less Dumb, How to Conquer Mob Mentality, How to Buy Happiness, and All the Other Ways to Outsmart Yourself. David, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think and email comments or questions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.